Good morning, everyone. And today is the 26th of February. Hard to believe, isn't it? And this is the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. We have scheduled an information meeting today to talk about economic development and cannabis. We have got six people that are presenting today. We have told them that we're going to be looking at about 10 minutes per presentation, including questions, so that we can get through the entire program in roughly 1 hour. Any questions before we begin? All right, well, I'd like to convene the informational meeting, and I will invite the first panel up, which will be Mr. Lerner, Mr. Schutte, and Mr. Bovet, excuse me. Good morning, gentlemen, and thank you for being with us. I hope the drive wasn't too long or too icy today.
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. And
you can use the clicker there.
We'll move the drive. As you guys are well aware, the way our office has been involved in the marijuana outlook for the state is that we now have the official forecasting responsibilities as of the last legislative session. Since that time, we put out our first forecast from our office in May of 2017. Since that time, the forecast has tracked reasonably well, not perfect. It's been come in above expectations to the tune of maybe $3 million in tax collections above our old forecast, which is 6%, 6.5%. So it's okay tracking. We haven't adjusted the baseline outlook for sales given that we've only done a few quarterly forecasts since. We don't want to let a couple months of data wag the 10-year forecast when it's something that's brand new to our office. We've been meeting with stakeholders and agencies and people in the private sector to try and get some information as we build our advisory group in terms of the outlook. So just an update on where we are in terms of actual collections relative to the forecast. Today, we want to talk a little bit about some of the issues that we're seeing within the industry, some of the economic development angles as well at the end. The first thing to note is that we expect sales to continue to increase into the future for a couple different reasons. One would have to do with black market conversions, things that were previously under the table, now being realized in the legal world. How much of the black market conversion we're getting at is a really hard estimate to make. Our office does not have our own. I know the state police have some industry folks and have some other estimates of their own. We're monitoring that information. But the other one is just pure social acceptance and usage increases. You can see here, in the last decade, the share of people willing to admit to government survey workers that they use marijuana in the last month has doubled, right? Here, Colorado, Oregon, and Washington have been above the U.S. average for quite some time, and we've seen larger increases than the U.S. average. And the 2016 number, which is really a 2015 to 2016 average, really popped in Oregon. We had a big uptick. Now, is that just data in the survey? We'll find out, right, in the next couple of years, once we get into this, more data into this legal market, how much usage increases is a key determinant of a long-term growth trend, right? 60% of Oregonians admit to using alcohol every month. Now we're at 16% for marijuana. So where does that usage rate go over time will really kind of determine the long-run outlook for how big the recreational marijuana market will be here in Oregon. At the same time, we're having more users, we think. We're seeing prices decline across all the legalized states. Oregon's prices are competitive with the sort of data we're seeing out of Washington and Colorado. They're declining about 10 to 20% per year, both at every level, the grower level, the processor level, and the retail world. And so it's getting cheaper for consumers in the legalized market. And as prices go down, we should see increased usage, increased demand. Demand curves do slope down in economics for a reason, right? Lower prices, you get more people purchasing the product. The one issue that we're seeing or potentially seeing, and you'll hear about it from some other speakers as well, is potential saturation from an employment or employer perspective when it comes to the number of growers and processors and retailers in Oregon. What this chart tries to show you is on the left-hand side, the three bars are how many marijuana stores or how many recreational marijuana licenses have been issued in Colorado, Washington, and Oregon. It's about the same. It's just over 500 stores in all three states. states, right? But of course, we have a smaller population than those other states. So on the right-hand side, you take those same number of retailers or same number of retail licenses and you divide by the population, we have significantly more recreational storefronts than Colorado and Washington. The error bars there are trying to get at some other adjustments. In Colorado, they have a very robust medical market. And so they have about 500 recreational licenses and about 500 medical licenses, but there's a lot of those are dual storefronts. When you merge them together and you try and look at how many stores actually sell marijuana, it's more like 700, 750 or something like that. And so that error bar gets to that total storefront. So if you include everything in Colorado, they have a little bit more stores than on a per capita basis than we do here in Oregon, but not significantly so. So again, this has some people interested or calling for a potential shakeout within the marijuana industry here in Oregon. Given the increased number of growers, processors, and retailers, and the falling prices, it's making some businesses' finances invert or flip, or they're having difficulty given the current industry trends. Is this a problem for the overall industry in the long-run outlook? I have a hard time getting to that point. It's going to be a problem for individual businesses that are having a hard time selling product above their cost of what they paid for it for their inventory a couple months ago or things like that. But overall, again, it's good for consumers. It's good to see those falling price trends overall. So again, on an individual business basis, this can be a big, big problem. But from an industry perspective, again, it's probably going to result in some consolidation, some sort of shakeout. How large and how fast will that occur? That's the open-ended question that we're not entirely sure of as of right now. Some of the issues and risk associated with the forecast to the downside, right? Obviously, the federal government, the rescinding of the coal memos to date has not had a noticeable effect within the data that our office looks at. But that doesn't mean moving forward there can't be some sort of intervention or some sort of policy put forward at the federal level that would significantly reduce the recreational legal market here in Oregon, and as such would significantly reduce tax revenues should something like that come to pass. Prices are the downside risk for tax revenue because we levy our marijuana taxes based on the price of the product. So the price is declining, great for consumers, but to the extent that it doesn't result in more usage or larger volumes of sales sold, will reduce tax collections relative to a higher priced item. On the upside, again, increased usage, larger black market conversion, value-added products, which would be a higher price point, right? We're getting more economic impact from a value-added product, from edibles, creams, extracts, things like that, relative to just the straight flower. And then compliance is both an upside and a downside risk, depending upon how well that goes or doesn't go. A key question that we want to talk about from an economic development angle is how many jobs are associated with the marijuana industry today? And there's really two hard numbers that are out there. One is the payroll employment counts that the Oregon Employment Department produces, which shows there's about 5,000 jobs in Oregon that they can track within the unemployment insurance records. The other hard number comes from OLCC that Bill will talk a little bit about here in a few minutes. That shows about there's 24,000 marijuana worker permits that have been issued in the last year, maybe last 18 months, right? And so the way our office has talked about it is we know the unemployment insurance records is probably an undercount of the true number, right? There's some seasonal work, there's some under the table work, there's some non-covered employment types that are out there. But at the same time, the 24,000 is certainly a high bar and an upper estimate, and probably not one that's perfectly used to gauge the size of the marijuana market, because we know there's more permits issued and more permits in the pipeline for workers relative to the actual number of jobs. And so we're trying to get a handle on this, just how many jobs are there and how do those permit numbers fall into it. So we looked at things like food handler cards, right? If you work in the food industry, most people have to have some sort of food handler card. And the best rough gauge we can kind of look at is there's a 3-to-1 ratio. There's three times as many food handler cards out there in the Oregon economy than there are food service jobs that roughly require a permit. So we'll probably see something similar in the marijuana industry. In Colorado, they've seen a 37% renewal rate in their marijuana worker permits after 2 years. Theirs is good for 2 years. And they're seeing about, a 3-to-1 ratio, roughly speaking, in terms of renewal rates. Same sort of thing with alcohol server cards. Roughly 3 or 4-to-1 ratio is a rough estimate of the Oregon data. So that means that the 5,000 payroll jobs that the employment department's putting out isn't really that bad of a number, right? Again, it's probably a lower bound. There's probably some more than that, but there's not significantly more than that because we know there's more permits floating around than actual number of jobs due to the seasonal nature of some of the industries. And the other thing is low-wage jobs tend to have a lot higher turnover. So maybe there's one position within a company, but then there's a lot of churn, a number of people cycling through that over the course of a year. And lastly, talking about the outlook for the marijuana industry, this is a chart our office uses occasionally to help frame the discussion of some of the things we're seeing within our vice revenues and in our vice economy here in Oregon. Our alcohol cluster, you know, has added more jobs in this business cycle than the high-tech industry has. Of course, these jobs aren't one-for-one equally relatable. High-tech, $106,000 a year, typical wage, and a lot of that's concentrated here in the Willamette Valley and in the Portland metropolitan area in particular. The alcohol cluster is more like $30,000 a year for a typical job, but that has a very evenly distributed footprint across the state, right? We have award-winning breweries in every corner of the state, and so you get a better geographic impact associated with the alcohol cluster. And here comes the marijuana with the 5,000 jobs. And so to date, a lot of these have been growing in retailing jobs, right? Low wage, low productivity, low value added types of employment in the economy. But the long-term outlook and where we really see our biggest bang for our buck and our biggest economic development will come from those value added products, the value added manufacturing, where we take a raw commodity like marijuana, we turn it into edibles and extracts and creams and that sort of stuff, and we'll then sell that, you know, at a higher price point into a niche markets. Of course, it has to be here in Oregon for the time being, but long term, if the federal government or when the federal government relaxes restrictions on interstate commerce when it comes to marijuana, you know, the long term potential for Oregon exporting our marijuana expertise, both from a physical product perspective and from a consumer services and consulting perspective, is really immense, right? Again, to the extent that we can develop new greenhouse technologies or new manufacturing processes here in Oregon, that'll really drive our long-term economic impact from recreational marijuana. Again, we haven't really seen it to date. We've seen some manufacturing jobs associated with marijuana. And if you look at the employment department's data, the manufacturing jobs for marijuana firms pay $10,000 more than the other ones, right? The growers and the retailers. So we're already seeing it in the data. It's just really small in terms of the actual number of jobs to date. But long-term, that is where the economic impact will come from. If all we get are growers and retailers, those will be jobs. They'll be relatively low wage. They'll be relatively distributed based on population size across the state. But that will not give us a really big bang for your buck. With that, that's all I have for prepared remarks. And if I answer any questions now or turn it over to
Why don't we hold questions till the end of the panel, unless somebody's got something specific and pressing. All right. Mr. Schutte, welcome.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. For the record, Bill Schutte, Chief Financial Officer with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. What I'm going to share with you today are some early results from our cannabis tracking system out of harvest, production, sales for calendar year 2017, talk a little bit about the licenses that are being issued in the state and where they're at, and then talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we're facing forward. I guess I'll remind the committee that every biennium, February of 2019, will be required to present a report to the legislature on supply and demand. That was part of the original marijuana legislation. We will be doing that. This is going to be an early look at some of that. I'll talk a little bit about the supply. We're not quite sure what the demand is yet. So as of yesterday morning, we had 1,724 marijuana licenses in the state of Oregon. About half of those are what they call producer licenses, those that grow. A third of those, or some of those, are indoor, outdoor, 360, and then there's a category of mixed producers that have both indoor and outdoor. It should be known that the difference between an indoor operation and an outdoor operation is indoor operations require artificial lighting over mature plants. That's really the only distinction. For outdoor producers, they can be field grown, they can be in greenhouses, hoop houses, as long as there's not the presence of outdoor of lighting. 108 wholesalers. Wholesalers have the privilege of buying and selling and storing. They also are being used for transportation of marijuana through the state. About 144 processors creates the recreational and medical grade products, and then 23 laboratories. Those have to be independent. They cannot be associated with a license type. All the other license types can be associated with each other if they so choose. They can have common ownership, but laboratories have to be independent. And as Josh alluded to, currently 527 licensed retailers in the state. So just a quick overview of where these are at. The producers are primarily lined up along the I-5 corridor. You see a big cluster in southern Oregon. That's where most of the outdoor producers are at. You have a mix of indoor, outdoor, and mixed producers all the way up into the Portland metro area. You will also see a kind of a gap or a lack of licenses in eastern Oregon. As most of you know, there is a provision for local counties and cities to opt out. Many of them have done that, although some of them have begun to opt back in. These are where the marijuana processors are located in the state. Again, up and down through the I-5 corridor, over in Deschutes County, but again, primarily clustered around the Portland metro area. Again, these are the licenses that produce the extracts and the concentrates that go into marijuana products. Laboratories and wholesalers. Wholesalers again store and transport marijuana. Again, the same pattern as we saw with the other licensees. Laboratories are also scattered through the state along that same corridor. And then the retail licensees in the state. And I guess I'll point out the one in Umatilla County. That was Pendleton. Pendleton had originally opted out of marijuana, but in the last November election, they have opted back in. Again, cities and counties cannot receive a share of the tax money unless they have opted into the system. As Josh mentioned, 24,000 active worker permits. These are required to work in the industry for all license types. Originally, they were just for retailers, but legislation changed it so that they all have to work into the get a worker's permit to work in the industry. There is an education and testing process similar to alcohol. They go through a criminal background check. They have to pass a test that they know the laws and regulations. Worker permit fee is $100 and it's good for 5 years. Even though we have currently 24,000 active, we have received a total of 42,000 applications. And of interest to us in the system, and we're not quite sure what's going on here, but there are over 16,000 that have been approved. They've been passed the background check, they passed the test, but they have yet to pay for their license fee. So it's one of the things in our system that we're having to deal with. A little bit about marijuana production. These are the gross numbers, wet weight harvest by month through 2017. You'll notice a pattern similar to agriculture. We probably saw almost 5 million pounds of wet weight marijuana harvested in the state in 2017, but over half of that occurred in October. So this really is an agricultural crop. Most of the outdoor grow operations complete their harvest in October with some spillover in November. But again, it gives you the agricultural properties of this crop, as you will. And then monthly sales. So we are tracking monthly sales, retail sales through our system. You can see that they've peaked out at between about over $50 million a month. They have declined somewhat in the last couple of months, and I'll show you perhaps why that is. We're not sure if this is a long-term trend or a short-term trend, but usable marijuana, that is flower, that's the orangish red line there, has been declining over the last couple of months, but the concentrates and extracts are still on a steady straight pattern upward over the last 6 months. The usable marijuana consumer sales in pounds have kind of leveled off between 8,000 and 9,000 pounds per month. Again, this is the flower or bud, the smokable marijuana, so to speak. So you saw the decline in sales before, so what is going on? And as Josh alluded to, price declines. As the harvest have come in, the cost per gram has fallen to almost under $6 per gram. Back when we first started the system, it was up to $9 per gram, but there have been steady price declines month over month in the system through 2017. So in summary, gross marijuana pre-tax sales total $519 million in 2017. Just for a comparison, alcohol sales were about $625 million. So there is an expectation that marijuana sales may eventually catch and surpass liquor sales. The total sales do include about $70 million or 13% to medical marijuana patients. So if you come into a retail dispensary, you show your medical card, you can purchase medical grade marijuana, which is often a higher dose, higher amounts, tax-free. And as Josh mentioned, there is a gross receipts tax on top of this of 17%. Some of the trends we are seeing in the market so far of usable marijuana sales as percent of the market, it was as high as 71% in January, but has now dropped to 59% in December of 2017. There seems to be, at least even in the short term, a shift towards concentrates and edibles rather than usable or smokable marijuana. And then quickly looking trends toward the future, declines in marijuana retail pricing. We don't know what that's going to do with the markets out there, as Josh alluded to. Supply and oversupply remain a discussion. We are still studying the effect of raw product conversion to extracts and oils. We know there's a lot of marijuana in our system, raw marijuana, but we don't know what the conversion rates are yet. Trying to get a better handle of how much of that will be converted to extracts and oils, how much of that will be stored in the future. But the longer term concern is market corrections and the impact on the number of licenses in the system. If we do see a large market correction, our recreational marijuana program is fee funded based on the number of licenses in the system. So that would require us to do some significant adjustments as all potentially. And then as Josh also alluded to, the potential of federal intervention in recreational markets does create some uncertainty out there. I guess we have the feeling that if we keep our system in order on the recreational side, the feds will hopefully lay off of us. I will say that we are doing investigations out there. We are doing compliance work. In 2017, I think we had almost 1,400 investigations underway, but they ranged anything from a camera going out to actual cases of diversion, which were the minority of the cases. But we have closed down two licenses because of that. But we are entering a compliance phase of that, and we hope that as long as we continue that compliance phase and keep the recreational market in there, that we will can be able to continue the recreational system. With that, I'll close.
Excellent. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Excuse me just a moment. Representative Marsh.
Yeah, I just thank you, Chair. I wanted to follow up on that compliance question. Do you feel like OLCC has the tools, the revenues, the staff you need to actually do compliance? There's a lot of question about that in Southern Oregon.
Chair Gombar, Representative Marsh, that is a very good question. We have received more resources for compliance, and we are continuing to do so. We know there's some legislation underway to get more resources, but at this point, there's a feeling that we could use more resources, and we're actively trying to get them.
Okay, and you're defining what those resources are and what they would be used
for?
Yeah,
it's mostly regulatory specialist.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Mr. Ovett.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Rob Ovett, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. I probably should note there are two members of your committee that were actually on the Joint Marijuana Committee that met for 3 years that crafted most of the statutes that I'm going to be mentioning here, Representatives Helm and Representatives Fahey. So some of what I'm going to talk about is probably boring to at least the two of them, but maybe new to some of the rest of you. I thought I'd just do two quick things here for you. A quick review of local regulatory scheme, what's been alluded to already, the opt-out and the time, place, and manner regulations, but spend most of my time talking about what I perceive to be the challenges to further growth of the industry in Oregon right now, and only talk about two of those because of the limited time. So first, I should let you know, my client, the Association of Oregon Counties, is decidedly neutral on the legalization of marijuana. It's my job to defend Multnomah County's right to have 10,000 marijuana businesses if that's what they want, and Harney County's right to have none if that's what they want. So that's put me in some interesting positions vis-a-vis both sides of this argument at various times. Right now, I'm spending more time defending our system from federal intervention these days. I do have a website and a webpage that I maintain with a lot of my publications that I've produced for AOC if you're interested. Quick review of local regulation. Just spend a minute or two on this. I'll talk about opt-in, opt-out, regulations, time, place, and manner, and land use, as well as taxation that's already been alluded to, so I won't repeat what you've already heard. This is the current map of Oregon's 36 counties in terms of their status, in terms of opting in and opting out of recreational businesses and or medical businesses. There's been a lot of elections held, a lot of decisions made by voters in these various counties. There are 241 cities. If I put a map of 241 colored dots on there, you'd all scream at me. So this is just the counties. Interesting things to note, for example, Gillum County, which is one of what I call a hell no county. They voted no on Measure 91 by more than 55%, voted to allow both recreational and medical. And you see various decisions by voters in various parts of the state.
Excuse me. Yes, Representative.
I'm sorry. Could you go back to that map for a second? Can you clarify? This is not all. I mean, we know that there are retailers over in Eastern Oregon because we saw them on the map. So what's this opt out? What's the red mean?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marr, so this is just counties. So this would be unincorporated areas. Cities can make their own decisions, and city voters have made a lot of their own decisions. So cities operate separately. So you can have a county that opts out but a city that opts in.
Thank you.
And vice versa.
Thank you.
Local regulations, we've seen a lot of activity by counties in the land use arena as well as time, place, and manner. A famous county judge once was quoted as saying, if you've seen one Oregon county, you've seen one Oregon county. I modify Judge Pryor's words to this extent. If you've seen one Oregon county's land use plan, you've seen one Oregon county's land use plan. So a lot of challenges, shall we say, in various counties. Some counties have not had to amend their codes. Others have had to amend their codes to deal with some of the challenges that the industry poses to residents. Local taxation, there is an option to supplement the 17% gross receipts tax with a 3% local option as well. We know from history that Oregonians generally hate sales taxes. We voted no on sales taxes 5 times, but we know that Oregonians love sin sales taxes, apparently, because we voted yes on local taxation of marijuana 111 times, and 111 times it passed by overwhelming margins. So go figure. Those are the 11 counties that now have a local option tax that put that on the ballot. There's a lot of cities that have done so as well. Some of the challenges. So here's where I want to spend a few minutes with you. I've just picked out two because, based on my perception, these are the things that are really kind of holding the industry back right now from further growth. The first is unavoidable, is the federal-state conflict that I'll talk about that we're struggling with still mightily today. And then the second I'll talk a little bit about, which is the struggle in rural residential Oregon between the industry's development and the happiness of rural residents. So the federal-state conflict, I like to start here, which is this is a little different than post-prohibition alcohol. So prohibition of alcohol was repealed in 1932. We enacted the Oregon Liquor Control Act of 1933 to regulate it, upon which Measure 91 was modeled, by the way. But right now we're still in prohibition. We are not in post-prohibition on marijuana. So it's kind of an odd policy arena to work in, and I know it has been for the members of the Joint Marijuana Committee, where we are literally crafting state statutes that authorize state agencies to issue licenses to people to commit federal crimes. It's a very unique policy arena, and you have to do some very interesting things when you're dealing with it, and it gets very technical in terms of crafting these statutes to provide the maximum protection for those who are actually licensees. But there are still a lot of federal challenges. I'll just mention two real quickly before I get to the big one. Section 280E of the Internal Revenue Code basically says, in generic form, that if you are engaged in the sale of controlled substances in Schedules 1 or 2, you and that's your business, you are not entitled to take normal business deductions. So you're essentially paying federal income taxes on gross income with some modifications. This is quite damaging to our marijuana businesses. We fixed it under state law, but we haven't fixed it under federal law. The banking laws are also incredibly problematic. It is possible for banks to do business with marijuana businesses, but they have to comply with something called the FinCEN memo, which is incredibly onerous. We have a few banks that do that. And so a lot of our marijuana businesses operate in pure cash, which has its own set of public safety problems, not just for the Department of Revenue, but for our sheriffs and a lot of other areas. Leakage is the biggest problem we're facing right now. Oregon is well known, and I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, as being a massive producer of marijuana that's leaked into the interstate and international black markets. We are a massive producer of marijuana, and we have been for a long time, and this well predates Measure 91. And that has posed quite a challenge. We have been attempting to craft legislation that the Joint Marijuana Committee has passed over the past 3 years to get a handle on this, to try to stop some of the bleed out and the leakage. And I won't bore you with all the details of that, but we actually had a meeting with the United States Attorney last year to talk about what we've been doing. He pointed out a few things that we still need to do, and we're working on those. As already been mentioned, the Cole memo was rescinded by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. For those of you not familiar with the Cole memo, let me briefly explain it in 30 seconds or less. The Cole memo, actually a series of three memos, were issued by then Deputy Attorney General James Cole and two others, that basically says federal prosecutors don't prosecute people for violating federal marijuana laws if they are in compliance with their own state's medical or recreational marijuana laws, and the state takes affirmative action to address eight areas of federal concern. Things like leakage into the black market, diversion to kids, guns, gangs, typical federal concerns. This is a pure exercise in prosecutorial discretion at a national level. And we constructed state laws in 29 states based on this memorandum. And this memorandum got revoked. And then there were all kinds of reactions. Some people were saying the sky was going to fall. Other people were saying it didn't mean anything. I think it means something in between. What it means as a practical matter on the ground is that the key, the person that holds the keys to this kingdom here in Oregon is the United States Attorney for the District of Oregon, Billy Williams. It's now back to him. He exercises prosecutorial discretion. And I'm thankful for Billy because he's not really in the political realm. He's been a career prosecutor his entire life, or entire adult life. And, you know, he is one that law enforcement is familiar with, we've worked with, he's a rational actor. So we've had a good relationship with Billy, and he actually issued an op-ed saying what his concerns are, and he laid them out. And then the two concerns I'm talking about primarily here today, leakage and conflicts in rural Oregon. He held a summit the Friday before we started session here, and Representative Helm and Representative Fahey were there, and we heard from a lot of folks from the industry as well about some of the challenges we're facing, including this massive leakage problem we have here in Oregon. Part of it runs around, quite frankly, the lack of enforcement resources in Southern Oregon. There are virtually little to no law enforcement resources, and the ability to actually do something about the leakage from there is limited right now. So we are trying to address at least a small piece of that this session with a program I can talk about, but we'll see if that makes a difference. Let me talk about another point of conflict that has been kind of at the forefront of what Billy Williams has been hearing about and what I've been hearing about, most particularly in rural residential Oregon, where the industry has moved in or grown and changed the, you might call, the livability standards. I think we're beyond the point of many in the industry claiming, oh, those are just naysayers. Those are just people that are didn't like Measure 91. I think we're way beyond that. But we've got real people with real concerns about lit up skies, smells, lack of water, real problems that are created when the industry behaves in a way that you could characterize as being a bad neighbor. Now, this is just some. This is not all. This is just selected some. But this has posed real challenges for my clients, commissioners in rural Oregon, who are faced with having to try to figure out how to best regulate this. They're dealing with these NIMBY issues weekly at commission meetings. RICO is another challenge that has now recently arisen in Oregon, and this is goes back to the same NIMBY problem and the federal problem, which is Under federal law right now, if you are engaged in a series of federal crimes that economically damages someone, that someone can sue you for treble damages, three times the amount of damages, plus attorney's fees. It's called civil RICO. We saw this action happening in Colorado quite a bit. I'll just give you one quick example. That Holiday Inn there used to cater to, actually it does again, cater to the Boy Scouts of America, high ski resort area. A marijuana shop moved in across the parking lot and the Boy Scouts of America disappeared, economically harming the Holiday Inn. The Holiday Inn sued that business and everyone associated with that business, about 30 to 40 people and banks and lenders and everybody else, and that business functionally had to close under civil RICO. So we've started to see those kind of actions being brought here in Oregon. Most notably, the first one was filed in Clackamas County with a neighbor who alleged that a marijuana grow site was behaving badly and damaging their property values. So location, location, location is really key when citing marijuana businesses these days. I can say probably safely that if you cite a marijuana retail shop next to a Taco Bell, that Taco Bell is probably not going to be able to sue you. In fact, they probably ought to be giving you some money. But if you cite yourself next to someone whose property is going to be economically damaged, RICO is out there, and there are now practitioners practicing in Oregon that are willing to take this up. So that's what I have for you in terms of the challenges. I can say finally that I am going to be going back to D.C. Later this week. I am doing my best and my part to try to find a pathway to the passage of a federal bill that will fix some of these problems that I've talked about here that is capable of passing the House of Representatives, the United States Senate, and being signed by the President. And this has proven to be a real big challenge right now.
Excellent. Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for all three presentations. Rob, is there anything that's happened since the U.S. Attorney's Summit that we were at that you can share? I want to give you a chance to expand a little bit on this distinction between the well-regulated market that I think we have in Oregon and what federal and state enforcement could be doing, so that we're clear that it was my takeaway from the summit that our state efforts to have a very solid, airtight system in which licensed individuals can participate in all aspects of the cannabis market in a legal way, that's going well. And the diversion is coming mostly from other elements within our state that are harder to control. And I just wanted to give you a chance to expand on that if there's any new news.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Helm, great question. Of course, I share your sentiment that we have a well-regulated system, at least on paper. And I think fairly generally, and this is bias, I think ORS 475B is the best marijuana system in the nation. Now, you and I had a piece of crafting it, so obviously there's some bias there. But as Billy Williams pointed out to us at the summit, that's all great, but what about all this leakage? What are you doing about the lack of enforcement resources against the true black market operators? And that is a real challenge. So we are trying to address some fine-tuning on the regulatory scheme, both in House Bill 4089, which is Representative Wilson's industrial hemp bill. We're cleaning up some of the potential leak sources there on the industrial hemp side. And then we have Senate Bill 1544, and I've got here the -16s, which need to become the -17s because they have problems. But I'm going to work on that later this morning. And this does a few things, including, and I'll just mention one of them, it provides, let's see if I can do this in 30 seconds or less. So right now, OLCC has been, and don't take this word wrong, but it's basically been skimming $1.25 million off the top of state marijuana taxes for the last few years, per quarter, $5 million a year, $10 million per biennium, and that's to ramp up their operations and enforcement. Now, pieces of that can now be reduced because they're taking in license fees to pay for part of their operations. So we're going to take 30% of that skim, which amounts to we're proposing to take $1.5 million per year, and give it to the Criminal Justice Commission to grant out to rural counties with little law enforcement and massive leakage to try to get a better handle on this. So I think I now have something. It's not as big as we need it. Colorado's doing the same thing at $6 million a year pursuant to legislation they passed last year. We're going to do $1.5 million per year, but it's a start. So I got something to tell Billy when he asked me.
Very good. Representative Helfrich.
Thanks, Chair. Question on, I went to a town hall earlier in the year, and it's relating to time, place, and manner on the marijuana, the grow operations. The concern that was in Multnomah County, even though it's not a rural county, as you referred to, as we saw on the map, it is fairly urbanized, except out where I'm at in my district in Corbett, there was concerns of the growers, and they're on the farmlands, they're in compliance with that part of the regulation, but they didn't pay to bring in the power poles to light up, to use power into their system. They bought commercial generators, and they weren't being good neighbors, and they're running these generators 24/7, and Multnomah County had a town hall to address those issues, and that kind of conflicts with what being a good neighbor is. And there, have you heard of that? Have you been addressed through the Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Helfrich, yes, I've heard way too much about that. Not just in Multnomah County, but in Deschutes County, in Josephine County, in Clackamas County, and that's why, in part, why we gave counties pretty much plenary authority to do time, place, and manner regulations to address these bad neighbor issues. And this has proven to be an enormous challenge. Noises, smells, light, and water, it all seems to revolve around those issues. In some of the more extreme cases, additionally, gun packing people that are kind of scary in the neighborhood. But I've heard those stories repeatedly, and I guess more importantly, I can tell you that U.S. Attorney Billy Williams has heard a lot from upset residents. So he basically laid it out. I think he made it clear to us, at least at the summit, I want you to address the leakage, and I want you to address the conflicts in rural Oregon with livability. And so I think we have the tools in place to do that, with counties and cities having plenary time, place, and manner regulatory authority. On the leakage side is proving to be an even bigger challenge. But we're going to struggle with this for a while.
Okay, thanks.
Senator Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Josh, one of the first screens you showed up there was the usage in Washington and then Oregon and Colorado, and I think they're around 13%. We're around 17% over 18. What do you attribute that to? Or do you have an answer to that?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Barreto, do not have an answer, right? Just consumer preferences about what they do in their social life.
They're smarter up there. Follow up?
No, they're not, but please, go ahead.
So the other thing is, you know, we're talking about leakage of the product out, but I'm thinking about the workforce here, you know, and, you know, as an economist and as companies require drug testing and how that's going to be affected down the road, especially right now where, you know, trying to find a workforce that's drug-free is starting to be a problem. And how do you see that going down the road?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Barreto, yeah, there's two different issues here that are kind of coming to a head. Is first of all, the one is the tight labor market today. It's hard to find a worker for anything today, given the unemployment rate's really low and the employment rate, more importantly, is really high, which is great. So it's hard to find a worker, and so businesses are having to adjust some of their hiring criteria, whether drug testing or screening is a part of that. I don't know specifically. I haven't seen it. If you look at some of the data coming from employer surveys about, you know, why they're having trouble filling positions, we know the drug-free workplace is an issue for some employers. It's not universal, but for some of them it is a no-go for a variety of reasons. And so you would think that if that policy remains in place on an employer basis, that an increased usage over time would hamper their ability to hire. And the other thing we're hearing about, some of the reasons for the drug-free workplace comes from insurance, right? You know, come from being able to get insurance for their businesses and also be subcontractors for larger ones, right? That's just boilerplate language in some of these contracts, is that it just has to be in there for those reasons. And so how those adjust or do not moving forward is going to become a bigger issue for some of those businesses. There's no question.
Yeah, just follow up. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, do you see leakage in business and jobs going out of state? You know, like Idaho is. If you look up least likely to legalize marijuana, I think Idaho's number four. You know, so are we going to lose jobs to Idaho?
Representative Gomberg, I think that depends upon a number of variety of factors, right? Workforce is obviously one of them, and also geographic location and proximity. We know, again, when we had we were discussing, say, minimum wage issues in recent years, when you're straddling a state border already, you know, anything in particular can help tilt the scales in favor of moving your facility across that geographic or that political border. This could be one of those tipping point issues, but it's not something that's on our radar as a major concern as of today, but doesn't mean it can't be moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Brock Smith, do you have a question?
I do.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you all for being here. If you go to slide three, please. That one there. Mr. Bovette, I really appreciate all your work on this for the counties. I remember discussing this with you back in 2013 in Portland, if I remember correctly, and in the beginning, right? One of the problems that we see in rural Oregon, especially in that big cluster in the southwest part of the state, is, of course, TPM, as you mentioned earlier, but also housing and the lack of availability when it comes to occupancy. I think Josephine County is less than a 0.5% availability when it comes to occupancy. And so when you have counties such as Josephine and Curry that don't have the resources to really go out in the field, and you mentioned water use, you got a lot of people camping on site. There's not proper facilities for them to deal with their waste and so forth. It's a big burden. And yet the resources from all of the grows that are occurring there, a lot of those resources are going up north to the more metropolitan areas because the tax, of course, is associated with the point of sale. And so we still need to do a lot of work in addressing that, in my opinion, and I believe the opinion of the commissioners in Josephine County as well as other areas. So my question is, how is the tax structure coming back to these counties now? Because I know my sheriff in Curry reached out recently about having this grant program that could be an issue with regards to him receiving revenues from the taxes to be able to help with his budget in enforcing the laws that exist.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brock Smith, so now I have to go somewhere real quickly. So what I described as the CJC grant program is really an alternative to what I think is a bigger, better solution, but I don't believe it has a path through this building. It's something I call the Southern Oregon Marijuana Initiative. I crafted it for a commissioner in Josephine County quite a few months ago. And basically, it would be a tax on production, and it would help provide baseline services in those hard-hit five economically most depressed counties where it just so happens we produce a lot of marijuana. We used to produce a lot of trees in those counties, and that provided a source of revenue for core basic public services, but that seems to have disappeared. So the Southern Oregon Marijuana Initiative I crafted, which would allow locals to vote on an additional supplemental tax on production on the on the recreational side by canopy, which is how OLCC operates. But the industry really, really, really does not like that proposal. So I don't have a path forward for that, I believe, in this session. But I can assure you I'm going to be coming back.
Thank you, gentlemen. Colleagues, we're going to have to move along. So I thank the three of you. I'm going to invite Mr. Houlihan, Mr. Morris, and Ms. Conroy to come up. colleagues are well planned and well intentioned outline today of taking about 10 minutes per presentation and being done in an hour has long since sailed. I'm still going to try and provide a full 10 minutes to each of our presentations here today. If anybody has to leave, we completely understand, but I'll stay on through. So who would like to go first? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Casey Houlihan. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association. We are a trade association of over 250 cannabis businesses throughout the state of Oregon. We are predominantly retailers, but we also have producers, processors, wholesalers, ancillary businesses, anybody who supports our broader goal of creating a robust and vibrant retail marketplace here in Oregon. The other hat I wear sometimes is I'm also Pacific Northwest Development for BDS Analytics, which is a market research firm and data analytics firm specializing in the cannabis industry. So we track consumer sales as well as consumer preferences, provide consumer insights with some survey work of what folks are looking for specifically. And I was able to use a lot of that data today to inform some of the materials we put together here. First of all, I'd like to say thank you so much to the committee for having this important informational hearing. There's quite a few issues that we still need to get resolved at the legislative and administrative rule level to improve the industry. Although overall, we are proud to report that it seems like legalization is a pretty outstanding success so far. We exceeded the state's initial revenue estimates by over 800% for the first year. So I would say that was pretty decent. And then also voters agree in existing legal states and other parts of the country as well that over 90% of folks support legalization policy once they've seen it enacted. This seems pretty resounding, and it seems like support is pretty universal for it. We've also seen so far some pretty tremendous economic growth, not just in Oregon, but in the other markets as they've come online as well. You can also see from some of the data here that it was in 2017 that Oregon's recreational markets finally surpassed Colorado's medical market. In many ways, these are some apples and oranges comparisons. We have many higher barriers of entry and especially cost to become a medical user here in Oregon. So in many cases, this is an imperfect comparison. But as you can see, one thing that we see very consistently from one state to the next is there is pretty reliable growth over time as these industries get online and as they expand the scope of the legal market within these states. We're also seeing an increase in normalization. This is leading to a broader public acceptance of cannabis at large, and we're not necessarily seeing a tremendous increase in new users as a result, but certainly a greater comfort around it. And as we've seen from some of our surveying, it seems as though folks, particularly in Oregon, are more interested in answering survey questions honestly than in many other parts of the country. So you can see here that this is a slightly different metric than what we saw previously, where I believe they were looking at adults within the last 30 days. We've explored folks within the last 6 months who've admitted to use, and we also tried to identify, as you saw on the previous slide, the percentage of folks that we've identified as acceptors or rejectors. Acceptors are folks that, in a social situation, if a friend or a loved one or something in that situation would offer cannabis, they might be in a position to accept it. And then the remaining 35% or so are rejectors who would say no under any set of circumstances. So we're also getting to get a bit of a clearer picture on what cannabis consumer looks like, although we're also seeing a lot of variances, and there's not necessarily one demographic that comes up as universal for cannabis consumers. As you can see, most of them are employed full-time. Many live in cities. 36% would describe themselves as very social, and almost half like to try new products. So this is very useful to determining the direction of the market moving forward. We're also starting to get a clearer picture as to why. And one of the interesting things as well is that as time goes by, we seem to be seeing more and more overlap between how people are describing recreational use and adult use. And as you can see, over a quarter of consumers here would describe their use as both. So this is an area where, especially moving forward, it may make sense for Oregon to re-explore the barriers that we have as a limitation to access to medical cannabis rather than recreational, which do stand as some of the highest in the country at present. Now, like I mentioned, we are not seeing one specific set of demographics rising to the top as a stereotypical cannabis consumer. We are starting to see certain trends emerge at large. We're starting to see certain typologies come forward within the market. We're starting to see older consumers. We're starting to see higher-end consumers. We're starting to see more product specificity at that level. And that's been a tremendous advancement over the course of the last couple of years here as well. We've also tracked over time how the adult use market, as well as the recreational market here in Oregon, has been picking up speed. And you can also look towards the beginning of Q4 2015 and as well as Q3 2016. The
bumps that we were able to see here from some of the policy changes the legislature enacted towards the end of 2015. That was early sales, which was using the existing medical marijuana dispensaries that we had to start our initial sales to folks 21 and over. Likewise, beginning of Q3 2016 was when we added the expanded early sales, which included adding edibles and extracts to what folks could buy during the early sales period. We're also definitely seeing over time more sophistication at the consumer level and at the product level, and we're definitely beginning to see a greater segmentation of the market across other areas. I believe the state economists had also referenced something similar, but especially in greater detail here, we're able to see what exactly are the biggest growing sectors of the market, and specifically what products within those seem to be attracting the most consumer attention. So that's something that, especially as we move forward, we've noticed some pretty significant changes in certain parts of the market over time. To that end, actually, if you look at, say, November of 2016 relative to December of 2017, which is the most recent month that we have data for, you can see that the share of flower sales in Oregon has dropped pretty dramatically from 57% to 43%. But one thing that I do want to point out is you'll also notice that in terms of dollars sold, there was actually a slight increase from those periods. So while we are selling more cannabis flower in terms of dollars sold, even just within the flower category, it is a much smaller share of the market on the whole, as you can see now. Some of the things that seem to be driving some of these other areas towards so much growth, in particular something like edibles, where you can see that they've more than doubled their share of the market just over a little bit of a year in between there. So as was also referenced earlier, the prices definitely have been trending downward, though, and certainly on the flower side, that has been significant. And so I believe right now the data that we have just for flower specifically was showing floating around $7 a gram, and that's closer to what we've seen in other states as they continue to enact legalization policies. I believe Washington right now is floating right around $5 a gram, as is Colorado. California is actually still above us on a per gram basis, but we can expect a fair amount of uncertainty as they proceed with their regulatory implementation as well. So, as I mentioned as well, even in terms of units sold, this was also a pretty tremendous growth over, say, the previous month of December 2016, rather. So this is something that we're seeing, even though the sales are increasing by a very small percentage, and we're also seeing very larger growth in terms of units sold. It's obvious that the price is coming down, and it's going to continue to come down as we move forward. As I mentioned before as well, it seems as though the biggest thing driving the overall expansion of the market seems to be new innovations or new branding, and that's certainly something that we've seen here over time. This demonstrates what some of those monthly sales were by category, both from December 2016 relative to the month previous, as well as the month in the year previous. So as we can see, candy and edibles more generally on the right here has been some of the faster growing sectors of the market as well. So especially as companies get more time to get online, to improve their branding, to increase their marketing, that's definitely been something that's expanded the industry on the whole. There's also a lot of additional opportunities that we think will be large areas of interest in the industry moving forward. Certainly pet products, as well as microdosing, smaller amounts of edibles, being able to control very small units of cannabis as you're ingesting them. Same true for gummy candies as well, which is, I think, one of the reasons why those tend to be one of the more popular items among consumers. They tend to be discreet. They tend to be easily dividable, so on and so forth. We're also seeing an increase in some of the other historically quieter areas of the market, like pills or capsules or tablets, which, as more businesses are becoming more advanced, we're starting to see some of these products develop a level of sophistication to them that consumers are finding appealing. As well as high-end vaporizers, we're noticing as well a bit of a concentration of the market on a higher cost item rather than, say, simply the lowest cost item. So as consumer options increase as well, we're definitely seeing more sophistication in their preferences as well. We had a few other recommendations that we were going to leave y'all with as far as things that we think could help increase the share of the legal market moving forward, which would in turn promote the growth of the retail industry here in Oregon and so on for everybody else up the supply chain. One of the ones that I'd like to point out right off the top, and this is something that had been discussed in the past, is Oregon is actually currently the only state with a legal regulatory system in place for cannabis where we are using 5 milligrams as a dose for edibles and 50 milligrams for the maximum concentration size allowed in one package. When we made that determination, Colorado and Washington had both decided on landing on 10 milligrams for an edibles dose and 100 milligrams for a concentration limit for package. We operated out of an abundance of precaution. The state of California has subsequently also decided to land on 10 milligrams doses and 100 milligram doses, which makes us the only one in this disadvantageous position. We do feel that this is limiting consumer demand on these items, particularly for higher dose consumers who are not going to purchase these products if they need to purchase multiple of them in order to have their intended effect. As well, we also had a bill in the last legislative session that I don't believe had made it much further than the Senate Judiciary Committee, but to enact similar off-hours employment protections for employees that are consuming cannabis outside of work, as Maine has recently enacted as well. So that is something that we think could help protect consumers and increase confidence in, you know, their ability to participate in the market without causing themselves problems. Likewise, we've also seen one of the bigger drivers of diversion being some of the strict testing requirements specifically for concentrates. One of the solutions that we'd identified is if we're able to divide some of those and create different testing criteria for concentrates that are intended to be turned into edibles rather than used for inhalable products, so that we could have a sort of food grade standard, which is not as high as, say, an inhalable grade standard. That could also prevent quite a bit of diversion in terms of folks not wanting to bring their concentrates or other products into the legal market if that's going to lead to a higher likelihood of them having that product confiscated or destroyed or otherwise testing for pesticides. There's also several issues related to overproduction and legal market saturation that I believe had already been touched on and I don't want to spend a great deal of time on, but I will specify that there are distinct differences between the in-state illicit market and the export illicit market here in Oregon, and it is critical, especially in terms of smoothing over any federal issues that we are currently facing with the inconsistency in our policy relative to theirs, that we focus on the out-of-state export market, which seems to be in large part not OLCC licensees, as we've recently seen, and I believe as U.S. Attorney Billy Williams had quoted in his Oregon Live piece some weeks ago, in terms of postal agent seizures, that in Colorado 2013 to 2017, they had seized 900 pounds and change of cannabis in outgoing packages. In Oregon, 2017 alone, we had seized over 2,600 pounds and $1.2 million in cash. So I think it might be significantly bigger of a problem here, and I don't think that the folks going to the post office in those instances are OLCC licensees in most cases. We also think that there's a lot of opportunity for non-criminal enforcement actions against folks that are operating in the illicit market, particularly here in the state, say, advertising direct consumer sales on Craigslist, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, other social media platforms. We are opposed to adding any increase in criminal penalties for folks that are involved in the cannabis industry. However, we do think that there's a lot of opportunity for other agencies or law enforcement to issue citations to folks that are operating without a license or to encourage folks to participate in a legal way. There's also some statutory changes that I know that we had suggested in the past and that I know that we will be exploring again in 2019. A lower sales tax, we still feel that at this point the illicit market is still so strong and accessible to consumers here in the state that it is still highly competitive against the legal market. We do feel that this is one of the few tools that the state has at their disposal to bring down the price to make our cannabis here more competitive for consumers, and that that would ultimately lead to an increase in the share of the in-state legal market. There's also some issues surrounding testing, and I know there's a lot of discussions about creating social consumption venues that I'm sure will be continued in the 2019 session. The same is true for interstate compacts, which I wanted to highlight, and then I'll leave y'all with this, because this is probably the number one solution that could address any of the in-state overproduction problems. Creating any avenue where we can export some of our excess cannabis within the legal system to other states that are badly in need in many cases. And Nevada, I believe last year, had relatively recently declared a weed state of emergency because they didn't have any. So if that was the situation where we were able to help, that would be a tremendous benefit to Oregon growers, to taking some of the pressure off their otherwise very condensed economy here within the state. I'm happy to answer any questions that any of y'all may have about this, and I also have access to more of the data that was on here as well. If anybody does have any specific questions there that we can be helpful with, please
thank
don't
you, Mr. Houlihan, but we're going to move along to Mr. Morris now.
Quite all right.
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this time. It is exciting to have
and sorry, I just need to have you introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Donald Morris, and I'm chairman of the Oregon Cannabis Business Council.
Thank you.
We are a trade organization for the industry, representing businesses from every facet, including growers, processors of edibles, topicals, and oils, as well as wholesalers, retailers, and consumers. The majority of our members are small and mid-sized cannabis companies and the ancillary businesses who partner with them, all of whom want a part of this growing economy. Small or large, industry or ancillary, the philosophy of the Oregon Cannabis Business Council is that everyone is given an equal voice. My journey into this industry began 10 years ago when my wife was diagnosed with fibromyalgia. The doctors prescribed a litany of pills, which she had negative reactions to. Someone recommended that she try cannabis. It worked for her, but there was no legal place to buy it. That is what set me off to provide safe access in a socially responsible manner for all Oregonians. I led the efforts to write and pass House Bill 3460, which legalized medical marijuana dispensaries in 2013 for just that purpose. At about that time, 5 years ago, I formed the Oregon Cannabis Business Council to bring cannabis businesses together to network, learn, and most importantly, build the legislation and rules forming the structure of our industry. Since then, our members have been active participants and leaders in regulatory and legislative matters. OCBC brings a unique perspective to the table when discussing the cannabis industry here in Oregon and beyond. We have worked with the legislature, OHA, and OLCC to formulate a model for cannabis governance that other states are now using to develop their own industry. OCBC relies on the advice and work of many people. We are fortunate to count among our board members Mr. Bo Whitney of Whitney Economics and New Frontier Data. Bo has authored many papers on the economics of growing the growing cannabis industry. His work has been reviewed and published by the New York Times, Newsweek, the Washington Post, just to name a few. Most recently, his work was presented at the White House, outlining the effects of 280E on the industry. Mr. Whitney is with us today so that he may answer any questions you may have later. We have submitted one of his briefs for the record, and I would like to share with you some of the more important facts. The average retailer in Oregon in Q4 sold $92,000 in product, making it very difficult for them to make a profit. Based upon the total current licensed suppliers, there is approximately 21 million square feet of canopy in Oregon. This does not include the additional producer applications currently in the OLCC queue. Prices are commoditizing, producer and retailers are in distress. The environment is ripe for consolidation by entities that are well-funded. The reality is that the market is flooded with cannabis. Because of this, small businesses, like many of our members, struggle to compete with both the illicit market and those licensed entities with deep pockets. Many will be forced to sell out to the larger chains. The governor's proposal this session to bolster law enforcement agencies is a good step to eliminating the illicit market. If licensed producers had to make up what is otherwise supplied to Oregonians, the legal market would double and the state would collect millions more in tax revenue. And many of the smaller mid-range businesses would be able to survive. In addition to these challenges, our industry suffers under significant over-regulation on the local level, often a result of fear of change in their community. We are also burdened by the ever-changing state regulations, which in some cases cause our members to spend millions in compliance costs. Finally, banking is another issue that affects all of us. The lack of services results in a cash economy for the industry. That not only poses a public safety threat, it complicates your job to oversee the budget. Turning now to federal issues, OCBC is a proud founding member of the newly minted Western Regional Cannabis Business Association. We consist of cannabis industry leaders from Hawaii, Alaska, Oregon, California, Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, and Montana. We've come together to address the federal issues that affect us all, but more importantly, we wish to lay the groundwork for the inevitable legalization nationwide. Much like Cornelius Vanderbilt, who found that as railroads crossed state lines, they required a uniform gauge of track, we have realized that certain standards for pesticides and growing lab testing, packaging, and labeling, to name a few, must all be standardized. Until the national question is called, we look to you, our state legislatures, as partners to ensure that Oregon is positioned as a leader in the cannabis industry and remains the model for the nation. Thank you, and I'm ready to take any questions you may have.
Thank you. We're going to finish up the panel before we go to questions. And Ms. Conroy, thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Chair Gomberg and members of the committee, my name is Molly Conroy, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Cannabis Association. The OCA is Oregon's largest professional cannabis organization, representing the cannabis business community at the local, state, and federal level. Our members include more than 300 cultivators, processors, edible makers, dispensaries, and allied businesses, including laboratories, security and transportation companies, and providers of legal and financial services. As Oregon moves beyond prohibition, we continue to seek clear and sensible regulations that promote health and safety in our communities, excellence in our products and services, and compliance at every level of the industry. As you may know, between January 2016 and August 2017, Oregon collected over $100 million in state and local taxes from the recreational cannabis industry. After the OLCC startup costs and other regulatory costs were covered, the state paid out $85 million to the school fund, mental health, alcoholism, and drug services, the Oregon State Police, the Oregon Health Authority, and cities and counties for enforcement of Measure 91. There's a stark difference in the allocation of tax revenue for cannabis compared to cigarettes and alcohol, most notably the 40% that goes towards the Oregon School Fund. A recent report from New Frontier Data estimates that by 2025, if all 50 states legalize cannabis for adult use, the tax revenue generated could be up to $131 billion, while also adding 1.1 million jobs to the U.S. economy. It is currently estimated that there are over 12,000 jobs touching the cannabis industry, resulting in over $315 million in wages, adding 1.1 million in economic activity in the state. Oregon's tax revenue and job creation from the legal cannabis industry should not be overlooked. However, the cannabis industry is an industry in transition and is still in the infancy stages of its lifespan and is attempting to find its groove. There is a massive amount of excess production in the state, and prices have decreased, as we've heard. The market needs to self-correct before the industry can stabilize, which we believe will happen. Although I'm not here to advocate directly for social consumption of cannabis, Oregon's cannabis industry will lag behind and suffer without changes. With no social consumption or sampling and hyper-restrictive licensing for cannabis-related events, Oregon is missing the boat on an integral facet of propelling the cannabis industry forward and creating even more economic benefits locally and regionally. Other states have established means to regulate consumption, sampling, and events in order to safely promote the industry. The OCA believes that it is in Oregon's best interest not just to encourage already existing cannabis businesses to succeed, but also to be attractive and competitive to new businesses interested in coming into the state. In 2016, the city of Denver approved Initiative 300, allowing businesses to apply for a new license to allow for adult marijuana consumption in designated areas. The Cannabis Consumption Establishment License allows adults over 21 to safely consume cannabis in a designated area. The business cannot sell or distribute any product, therefore requiring consumers to bring their own. This initiative also allows for cannabis consumption special event licenses, following the same rules as the establishment license. Similar to Oregon's law regarding locations for cannabis businesses, these new licenses must not be within 1,000 feet of a school or childcare facility or in a purely residential zone. Normal cannabis license facilities cannot apply for these establishment licenses, and alcohol is not permitted to be served or consumed. Additionally, these establishment and event licenses must be compliant with the Colorado Indoor Clean Air Act, and each license must have evidence of community support. This past fall, Nevada's Legislative Council Bureau released a statement advising that there is currently no Nevada state law prohibiting local governments to allow for the permitting of cannabis consumption in businesses. Therefore, it is up to the local municipalities to decide whether consumption lounges are to be allowed. In Las Vegas, discussions are underway to allow consumption lounges, and there are already businesses ready to launch when approved to do so. California also allows local jurisdictions to decide whether to allow or prohibit on-site consumption at dispensaries and allows businesses to apply for a temporary special events license to consume and sell cannabis at events like county fairs. Not only will these states enjoy the tax revenue from these cannabis consumption businesses, but they also give tourists a safe option to consume rather than prohibiting public consumption and therefore potentially inadvertently encouraging tourists to bring legally purchased cannabis back to their home states. None of these are perfect solutions, and Oregon will have to find what is right for our state in regards to these aspects of the cannabis industry. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak on this issue of economic development in cannabis, and ready for questions.
Thank you. Representative Helm, Representative Marsh. Thank you for staying with us till the bitter end. Do you have any questions?
Well, I don't have a question so much. Just thank you for being here today, all three of you. These three organizations have been fundamental in informing what we have today, and I agree with Mr. Bovet that our system is clearly the best and the newest and a model. And our cooperation with organizations like these is critical to moving forward as we develop the industry here in a legal way. So that's my statement. My question is maybe to you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot. This may be a hope rather than a question, but
I'm sorry, we're running out of time.
Does the informational session indicate that our committee may be in the future tasked with issues involving the cannabis industry?
Well, thank you for that question, Representative. I certainly hope so. And part of our desire here, quite candidly, was to once again begin to stake out some turf for the future involvement of this committee on this emerging topic, particularly on the aspects involving economic development and an emergence of a new industry in Oregon.
I heartily hope so.
Indeed. Well,
let
me ask this panel a question. And the context of my question is I'm coming from a community of about 5,000 people that has about 5 retail stores. We happen to be at the beach. Tell me a little bit, as long as we're talking economic development, about the intersection of the cannabis industry and tourism.
I think it has the potential to take off. We already have, you know, some B&Bs, for instance, that are cannabis friendly. A hotel tried it, but it was shut. You know, they had to end that. It's important to develop areas where people can consume legally, rather than feeling like they're a criminal when they're on the beach, smoking a bowl or a joint, and you know, on their vacation. I think we could generate millions more in tax revenue. The restaurants, the inns, whatever, they all become part of the equation in generating more, you know, where cannabis can generate more revenue for them.
Excellent. Please.
Casey Holand, for the record. I also wanted to add to that. I think that the only thing that's distinct that is also going to be a big potential for Oregon further down the road as well is if you look towards California, which is seen in many ways as the leading wine producer in the country, certainly certain areas of it as well. I think that Oregon, especially some of the southern parts that we saw on some of those maps, the higher production areas, also has a lot of potential longer term to attract a bit of a specific cannabis tourism economy, which would be distinct from folks that happen to be buying cannabis while they're vacationing in a beach town. But I do think that longer term that could pose a bigger opportunity for the region in that area, specifically for bringing in folks that have a very specific focus on that, that would like to go around and see some of the production areas themselves, try things out, bring things back. This may be several years down the line, but I think that that's what we're going to be looking at in the future.
Excellent. Please.
Just one more point. I think, you know, in Oregon, we do have a big overproduction, excess production issue, and potentially attracting more tourism to the industry could help address that, as it's not just for residents of the state, but for people who are coming in.
Very good. Representative Marsh, and then we're going to have to wrap, please.
Yes, and I'm going to ask a question and ask you to get me your thoughts later on, because I know we're really out of time here. But I think this question of how the industry settles down is a huge one. One of you suggested that the big players may be the ones that survive out of that, and yet our legacy of cannabis production has really been the small players. And I think there's a lot of desire to keep those small players in business. So the question is, are there steps that we could take, not to regulate the market, but to encourage or protect the small growers as the settling down takes place?
All right. So you've asked them if they could get us some feedback on that.
Yeah.
And if you get that to Ms. Leone, she will distribute it to the rest of the committee members. Well, look, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. I do apologize that we've run a little short on time. This is the point in session where people have commitments and they're needed to be 2 or 3 different places at once. So don't take the fact that the majority of the committee has had to exit as anything more than the simple fact that they had to be someplace else. And all of us need to be someplace at 10 o'clock. So we are going to adjourn the informational session with gratitude to all of you that have spoken to us today. As Representative Helm indicated, I expect we're going to be continuing this conversation, and it's a beginning in this committee, not a one-time event. Colleagues, this is our final scheduled meeting for the session, unless something comes across to us from the Senate that demands our immediate attention. So stand by for news, but otherwise, you can have your 8 o'clock hour and your and 9 to 9:45 back. Ms. Leone, I wanted to thank you for your help during the session. as well as Ms. Daniel, who's been very quiet but very effective over on the side, keeping track of everything. I'll remind you that that OLIS has a record of everything that's been presented here today. If you want to share that and your presentations with any of your members, and certainly the members of the committee that aren't here are going to be able to go back and review that information. So anything else for the good of the order?
No.
Then we are adjourned.